This is Where We Live. I'm John Dan Cosby. Coming up, we'll take a look at cheap high culture in the Rust Belt. Alec McGillis will tell us why cities like Cleveland and St. Louis are offering fine art at a surprisingly low cost. But first, since the 1970s, musicians Paul Howard, Tom Hagmassi, and Phil Zimmerman have been playing together under the name Last Fair Deal. Their music puts an original twist on the old sound of American roots music, drawing on influences of legendary performers like Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and Bob Dylan. Today, the trio joins us in our Studio 3 to share some of the music that they've been playing together for the past 40 years, like this song called String Band Swing.
I like the fiddle, but the strings in the middle are the ones that I like the best. I pick my mandolin, whatever shape I'm in.
Paul, Tom, and Phil, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so we just had on Max Creek not too long ago.
Oh, gee.
And Max Creek has been... Max Creek has been playing around this area since the early 1970s, and you guys go back almost as far as Max Creek. 1974, if I got this right, right?
We shared a gig with Max Creek in 1975.
So that is a ways back.
Right.
So what's the origin story? How'd the band start?
Well, I moved to Connecticut in 69 and fell in with some musicians, acoustic musicians that were interested in bluegrass, and we had a kind of a put together band. We had a job in Boston, and our fiddle couldn't make it. Somehow, Tom.
Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. Somehow, Tom Hagmassi sat in with us instead, and a year or two later, we saw each other at a parking lot at a bluegrass festival. Tom had just gotten his degree from UConn, and he's moving to my neighborhood. Said, "Let's get a band together."
Yeah.
In classic style, that's what happened.
And we did.
Yeah, that was in 72.
Yep. That was in 72.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And so how did it develop from there? I mean, you start with the sort of a love of bluegrass music and playing bluegrass instruments.
Right.
And is that really what you wanted to do, just to have a traditional bluegrass band, or was the other music that was going through the air at the time sort of
– At that point in time, we were learning the traditional things, but we always had as a five-piece bluegrass band, we always had contemporary songs in our repertoire. So we were never a purely traditional bluegrass band in that sense.
And, of course, the whole idea of a traditional bluegrass band in New England is something that – you know, there's so much bluegrass music up here. But, again, it comes from a different place. Did you always feel bluegrass music in New England sort of had to add a little something different? It had to be different than Appalachia.
Adapting it to our environment.
And when did you start playing mandolin? I mean, when did you pick this up?
I picked it up in college at University of Rochester in 65, 66.
And you're just listening to records and just playing on your own, or you schooled in this?
Listening and watching, trying to get to live performances.
Yeah.
This is oral tradition, this music. So until the last 10 years or so, when there's a lot of written learning aids, videos, tablature, but I learned by ear.
How about you, Tom?
I got pulled into it by the guy who stood next to me in Chem 2 class. And he played the mandolin. And, you know, we talked about music. And he said, I'm going to get a band together. We need a fiddle player. And I had a fiddle up in the attic. You know, had to figure out how to scratch a few notes out of it. And just kept on scratching.
Just kept scratching. You're still scratching to this day.
And you never stop scratching, though.
So Tom Hagmassi and Phil Zimmerman, both original members of the band. Paul Howard, you've been with this band for a very long time, but not from the start. How did you get involved? How they rope you in?
I joined up with these cowboys in 1975. And interestingly enough, I actually saw the original five-piece band play at a concert one time. A friend of mine said, "Hey, come and see this really good bluegrass band." And I went and saw them, never thinking that I would be playing with them, because I wasn't really coming from a bluegrass background as much as these guys were. I had grown up playing rock music in high school and gotten into kind of acoustic stuff, and then started to discover bluegrass and country style little by little. And I was very enamored with people like Jonathan Edwards in the early 70s, and Dan Hicks was a big hero of mine. So I was starting to play some swing music and some bluegrass-oriented stuff, and I really was looking for mandolin and fiddle instead of guitars. Everybody was always playing guitar. So I discovered bluegrass through wanting to play with mandolin and fiddle. And then one day I saw an ad in the paper that Last Fair Deal was looking for a singer, a guitar player.
That's so interesting.
And I answered the ad and met these guys. Yeah. And I had some songs that I'd written. They kind of liked my songs, and we hit it off, and we've been playing ever since.
My goodness. Well, actually, I want to hear one of your songs now, and I want you to tell us about it. It's a song that I've heard you guys play live now a few times, and it's a beautiful song called The Voice of an Early Snow. Can you just tell us the story behind this song before we hear it?
Back in the late 80s, I moved to Goshen, Connecticut.
Not too far from where I live. I know Goshen quite well.
That's right. And I lived up in that neck of the woods for almost 20 years. And at one point, we moved up into the northern part of town in Goshen. I'm an avid hiker and mountain bike rider, so I was exploring the woods, and I realized that there was a lot of old foundations and settlements that dated back to the period right after the Civil War up in the north part of Goshen. And you know, I discovered these things out hiking, and I went to the Historical Society and got a map and started looking around, and I got very interested in what had really gone on up there. And found out about the fact that the water company had bought up all the property at one point and relocated all the farmers and then burnt down the buildings that were left. And so the foundations were all there, a couple of sawmills, and started to research it a little bit. And with a little help from some of the people from the Historical Society, I also started to find out about Goshen's role in the Civil War. And so sitting around playing a few chords, the song started to come out of that. And my buddies heard me talking about how I discovered this book that was written by a fellow from Goshen. His name is Ernie Barker. And he wrote this book called Fred and Jenny, which is about a Civil War soldier, Fred Lucas, and his girlfriend, Jenny Wadhams. And he had written a lot of letters home, which still survive, to her and his mother. Very different letters to his mother and his and his girlfriend.
I'll bet there are different letters.
Right. So I, you know, started hearing about him and thinking, what an interesting thing this is. And it started to work its way into the beginnings of a song. And then I think Tom said to me one day, he said, now what we really need is to make this a ghost story. And so taking a little artistic license, the same way that Ernie had done in his book, it was not an exact historical document. It's a little bit of a historical novel, kind of. I thought, well, if he can take license with this story, maybe I'll push it a little bit farther.
I love it. It's a great backstory for a story. Let's hear the song now. It's called The Voice of an Early Snow. And the band is Last Fair Deal, Paul Howard and Tom Hagmassey and Phil Zimmerman. They're playing live for us in our Studio 3 here on Where We Live.
She roams through the hills of November, up where the wild streams flow. She promised one night in a letter to go where the mountain laurel grows and wait till the winter wind blows. Her lover had gone for the Union, enlisted in June 62. The fields of Camp Dutton had called him, young Colby, the Wadhams kid, too. Their coats were a deep Yankee blue. His letters all reached her in Goshen. She waited for his sweet return. A year on the Potomac, he stood guard. The musket and saber he learned, and marched in as Cold Harbor burned. She first appears in the fall near Norman Apley's sawmill. She's a gale that howls in November, the voice of an early snow. His pen never wavered. She prayed that he'd be home by fall. They wrote of a place that they treasured by the mill where the hoot owl calls. But he knew that he might lose it all. He fought hard to capture the Petersburg lines. Lee's army was tough to the end. brave word she wrote never reached him. The second had rails to defend, and his last letter he'd never send. She first appears in the fall near Norman Apley's sawmill. She's a gale that howls in November, the voice of an early snow. From the county limped home. She walked many times to the sawmill, but each time she went there alone, cried for her lover who'd gone. The fall brought a chill wind to Goshen. The news came, but she'd gone away. Paid for the summer she'd meet him. Up by the mill, the men say, her vigil she keeps till this day. She first appears in the fall near Norman Apley's sawmill. She's a gale that howls in November, the voice of an early snow.
That's Last Fair Deal, performing live in our Studio 3 here on Where We Live. That's the voices of Paul Howard and Tom Hagmassi and Phil Zimmerman. Paul plays guitar and sings. Tom sings and plays fiddle, and Phil Zimmerman is playing mandolin. The song, The Voice of an Early Snow. I love, obviously, for a show like ours, Where We Live, I love the idea of a very place-specific song, and it places me in Goshen, Connecticut, in this town that I know so well, but it does have this sort of ghostly feeling to it, too. Do you feel as a writer that you're thinking often about the places where you are, like the surroundings that you have being an inspiration to you?
Yeah, I think that's often the case, and sometimes it's more things that come to you maybe in a dream or something, too. So, you know, but the place is definitely an important aspect. Yeah.
Phil, I'm wondering if you can talk about playing music with the same band for such a long time and how you get to know each other's musical movements and the sounds that each of you make. Because it's one thing to just click with some new players for the very first time. And there's a great tradition in bluegrass and in jazz of that, of sitting in on a session and just clicking with people, and then it dissipates. But when you get to play with people for such a long time, what does that do? Tell me about that.
Well, it becomes very intuitive. We can kind of anticipate, and arrangements fall together very easily now. We take new material into the band, and it takes a half an hour maybe, we have it arranged to perform. It's great. I do play in a couple of other bands that are more pickup style bands, and that's fun too. But it's also fun and comforting to know what's going to happen next if you're in front of an audience.
For the audience too, Tom, I think one of the things that's a lot of fun is, like a lot of traditional bluegrass style or string bands,
you often perform just in front of one microphone. And there's a beautiful choreography amongst the three of you when you step forward to the microphone and the way you space yourselves. It actually helps the audience orient who's playing next, and it's a very graceful thing to watch as well as to hear. And I love that choreography. Could you talk a little bit about doing that and how it's developed?
I would say Under Fire is how it developed. We never actually sat down and had a chart. Paul, you stand over here. But
I would say
we pay attention to what each other are doing, and you know, it just falls into place.
It takes some of the power away from the sound man too, which is often a good thing.
That's often a good thing. It's often more control in the hands of the artist, right?
That's right. And it's very freeing to the musicians on stage to not be tethered to a spot. So the fact that we can play acoustically and move in and out of the mic to create our own dynamics, and we can tell that it does a nice thing for the audience too. You know, the visual of it is nice. And we've been having a lot of fun playing that way as often as we can. We try to go that route.
Now, the band used to be a five-piece. Playing with three, I mean, how does that open up the sound? How does it change things being a group of three as opposed to a larger, more traditional bluegrass size band?
Well, I think the biggest thing is we've got a slightly more contained sound with three pieces. It's maybe a little folkier than we were. They started the band with a five-piece band, but then for many years we were a four-piece with a bass player. Had many bass players over the years, including my son Todd for about 7 years. And when Todd left and moved to California, we just thought, you know, instead of trying to find a bass player to replace him, as good as he was and as fun as it was to play with him, we had never really experienced playing the three of us as a trio. Let's try it. And we quickly discovered that it was really a lot of fun, and it's been really a learning experience and a new adventure.
Tom, one of the things I love about your playing that I heard in that first song is you essentially have back-to-back violin solos. You have one that's a very traditional kind of Celtic reel violin solo, and then it's followed with kind of the rock guitar version of it, the jazz fusion version. Is there a way that you prefer playing the violin?
Oh, I guess I like it loose.
Like it loose.
I guess I'd have to say that.
Yeah, well, you were the one we were talking about. Yeah, how many takes are we going to take? Yeah, just one take and it's done. It's sort of the way you approach things, right? Let's just plow through it.
One take.
It's just, and this, do you guys all share this sort of feeling, like this sort of organic feel of the band is the way to go, or is one of you a little bit more like, well, we need to try that over and over again?
I think that's true.
We lean towards the quicker approach. I know in the studio when we record, I love to do things in one or two takes. That's it. Yeah. I don't like to belabor it. I always feel like if you're prepared and you go in and do it, those early takes will be the strongest.
We're talking today with Last Fair Deal. They're a local trio made up of musicians Paul Howard, Tom Hagmassey, and Phil Zimmerman. When we come back from the break, we'll continue our conversation and listen to some more music performed live for us here in our studio.
Took me home this is and led me inside. Changed my luck again. You heard I had a checkered reputation. You'd seen my kind 100 times before. You never offered any kind of explanation. You dragged me through your door. It's driving me out of my mind. You rattle my brain. I can't explain the fire that I'm feeling this time. Left all my dark days behind.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we have the band Last Fair Deal in our Studio 3.
When times are good, they fly. Like the wind in the morning to a distant sky. Like the changing weather, a roller coaster ride. Keep on climbing higher, screaming down the other side. Mixing pain with pleasure, but we ride, ride, ride. Roll from side to side, take care. hello from goodbye. The difference I can't measure. Words fall like rain. Though action speaks much louder, clockwise down the drain. Like the old bathwater, people cry and scream. Not taking it much longer, holding to a dream. Brother, just like daughter, give it time, time, time. Change is like your mind, I saw but now I'm mine. Led the lambs to slaughter. When the world spins round, you're upside down. Gonna plant a garden row. Hold the weeds from the flowers and nurture it to grow. The secret to survival, a vow from groom to bride. Pledging love forever, children named with pride. From the pages of the Bible, it goes on and on, here and gone. And when you think it's done, sleep becomes revival. When the world spins round, you're upside down. You're upside down.
The song is Upside Down, and the band is Last Fair Deal. They've been together since the early 1970s, and they're playing for us here in our Studio 3. Paul Howard, Tom Hagmassi, and Phil Zimmerman. Tell us about the song.
Well, this is a tune that I wrote. It was kind of inspired by, years ago I used to substitute teach once in a while, and I was in a classroom, and there was this big poster on the wall of the world with all different ethnic groups all sticking out of the world all around, including some being upside down. And the thought just got to my head that as when the world goes round, you're upside down.
Yeah.
And so that kind of prompted a little bit of a story that we called Upside Down.
And I love that song. One thing that's so interesting, the first time I heard you guys play, that song to me sounds like one of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Grateful Dead tunes I don't know. You know what I mean? Because there's so many songs they played over the years. I thought, is that a dead tune or is that an original tune? When I found it was an original tune, I'm like, that's a really good song. But it does have that Grateful Dead feel. Were you inspired by the Dead?
Not a whole lot.
Yeah,
but I mean, certainly influenced by having listened to them. And that's an example of one of our types of arrangements where we've tried to add some more modern elements as opposed to a traditional kind of arrangement where it kind of turns into a bit of a jam tune at the end. Where it opens up a little bit. And we've kind of done that in a few of our original arrangements where even if the main part of the song might be a fairly traditional kind of thing, it has other elements that get tacked onto it. Slightly longer form, maybe you might say.
Well, you guys have a lot of gigs, both solo gigs and gigs as a band coming up. Tom, you're playing with a Ken Moore band at the Windsor Arts Center. Could you just tell me about that?
I think that's the 16th. We're playing on one at the Wadsworth on the 2nd. And then following that, there's that one on the 16th is a Windsor Arts Center.
Tell me about your relationship with Ken Moore.
Ken is more or less local to me. I live in Torrington and he lives in Colebrook. So it's a 20-minute commute to practice.
I like that.
So that's a big part of the whole. But he's a singer-songwriter, and we have kind of a hip folky band behind that backs him up and plays a lot of the concert on the green things and libraries and those things locally. Occasionally, we wander into New York State.
And I know Phil, you got a thing coming up. You're musical director at the Mandolin Camp North. In Charlton, Massachusetts, really?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
So that camp has been going. It was started by a guy, and he now lives on Cape Cod, Mike Holmes. Started mandolin camp 10 years ago. He actually started a previous camp, Banjo Camp North, 15 years ago, and both those camps are still running. I've been a music director for about 10 years.
Do you feel like more young people are getting into playing these traditional instruments? Because it seems like there's more outlets. There are more bands being formed with banjos in them and mandolins in them and string basses. This is something that, 10 or 15 years ago you wouldn't have had, and now you've got kids wanting to learn mandolin.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a lot of fun and it's real exciting.
And it's a whole new part of music. And I know, Paul, you guys have some other gigs coming up, including at the Outer Space in Hamden, and there's a lot more going on. What's the plan for you guys? I mean, how often do you plan to play each year? And, how long you hope to keep this going? Because this has been a long-term musical partnership. What's the future hold here?
Well, we enjoy playing together. In fact, right now we've started to work up some new material for a new recording that we hope to do before too long. And we're in the process of learning and arranging some. We're hoping it'll be mostly an original project. So we're starting to work up some new original tunes. Tom's got a backlog of a few tunes. I have a few. We're getting Phil to work on a banjo tune, just trying to get all the different elements of what we do in there. And so that's coming up. And, we get a little busier in the summer because we try to do some park concerts, the occasional festival. This year we'll probably be playing on the green in Litchfield. We do that. I think Naugatuck. We've got a couple of other shows in the works that aren't finalized yet for the summer. Those will be coming up. You mentioned the Outer Space, which I think is May 19th. And then also there's a bluegrass series that was at the Firebox in Hartford that's now moved over to the Half Door and run by Nick Novia. And we're going to be there on Sunday, June 7th, playing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at Nick's Sunday bluegrass thing.
I was going to say it's one of the longest running bluegrass things going on in the state, and so glad that it's got a good home. And that's our local bar down the streets. We love the Half Door. Well, I'm so thrilled to have you guys here, and I really appreciate you coming in. I've seen you guys play live a couple times, and it is always a lot of fun. But it's really a great pleasure to have you here. So to Paul, Tom, and Phil, last fair deal. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having us.
You can find out more about their upcoming shows and albums by visiting our website wnpr.org. There we also have a link to Phil Zimmerman's book, Bluegrass Time, which features a stunning collection of photographs from the early days of bluegrass festivals. When we come back from our break, Slate staff writer Alec McGillis will tell us about low-cost, high culture from the place where I come from, the Rust Belt. You can join our conversation 860-275-7266, comment on our website, wnpr.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. River's rolling now, it's overflowing. There's a cold wind blowing us apart, and the forecast seems so bleak to me. I hope a raging hurricane don't blow me out to sea. But whether or not I stand by you, whether or not you're here with me, believe it or not, my heart is true. And whether or not I stand by you,
that sunny weather, how we'll walk together. There could be no other in my heart. And the sky is looking clear and bright. Find shelter from the storm in my baby's arms tonight. But whether or not I'll stand by you, whether or not you're here with me, believe it or not, my heart is true. And whether or not I'll stand by you, whether or not I'll stand by you, whether or not you're here with me, believe it or not, my heart is true. And whether or not I'll stand by you, whether or not I'll stand by you. And when the cold wind blows in the wintertime and the wolf is scratching at the door, I'm just like an old love letter. I'm yours forevermore. When the sun beats down in the summertime and the wind refuses to blow, I'll rain my love down on you, gonna make the river grow.
This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Hope you can join us tonight for The Mouth. It's part of Hartford's Storytelling Week called The Thread. The Mouth is a storytelling event at the Mark Twain House and Museum. It's hosted by WMPR's own Kyone Wolf. The theme tonight is Thrown for a Loop, Stories with Twists and Turns, featuring Lynn Butler, a photographer whose work is featured at the Coney Island exhibit at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. Hope you can be there tonight at 7:30. Again, The Thread is a week-long series of storytelling all across Hartford, and The Mouth is part of it tonight. Hope you can join us. Coming up on Monday's show, a new book peers into the personal and professional life of one of America's most influential artists, Mark Rothko. On the next episode, we'll talk to the author of Mark Rothko, Toward the Light in the Chapel. We'll also hear from a local artist whose far-out sci-fi-inspired work is now on display at the New Britain Museum of American Art. Hope you can join us on Monday's program. Today on our show, we've got another arts-themed conversation for you. A bit earlier, we heard Last Fair Deal perform live in our Studio 3. Now we're shifting gears a little bit to talk about a different type of fair deal, that is the low cost of high culture in the Rust Belt, towns like Baltimore, St. Louis, and Detroit, how they're working to attract patrons of the arts. Alec McGillis is a journalist who wrote The Rust Belt Theory of Low-Cost High Culture for Slate. Alec, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
How did you start noticing this trend of low-cost high culture in Rust Belt cities?
Well, I noticed it right here in Baltimore where I live. I moved back to Baltimore a couple years ago from Washington, D.C., and one of the first things that just struck me when I got back here, I'd lived here about 7 years earlier, but when I came back here, I was just amazed by all these incredible deals that I was being presented with as a Baltimore resident for basically high culture here in Baltimore. I got a deal for the best theater in town for a $100 season pass, which worked out to about, you know, seven plays at about, what, $13, $14 each, roughly the cost of what it costs to go to the movies in some expensive cities. I was going to see these great plays. I got a season pass for the very good Baltimore Symphony Orchestra for $75 for the entire year. These are just a couple of the deals that I was being confronted with. And it just got me thinking about what's going on in these cities that have these really rich cultural legacies from back when they were much better off, more prosperous cities. And they still had these great institutions from those times. Yet at the same time, of course, they're now in a situation where they're under pressure to fill those seats because the cities are not what they once were. And so it creates this sort of amazing golden middle for someone here in the cities to take advantage of.
And a place like Baltimore, of course, people don't think about Baltimore being one of America's largest cities, but not so terribly long ago it was. And the other places that you profile, places like St. Louis and Detroit, Milwaukee, these are all cities that once upon a time, they were some of the biggest, most prosperous cities. And that's why they have this great artistic legacy. But as you note, Alec, a lot of that shine has gone off of the cities, and now there's a resurgence in many of them. And you feel like the arts is kind of leading the way.
Definitely. And I just wanted people to sort of be aware that there are these incredible opportunities out there. Both, I wrote the piece in a way both for people here in Baltimore. I want to make sure that people in Baltimore were aware that there were these just really amazing deals for them to avail themselves of. But I also wanted to make sure that people in other cities, in cities like New York and Washington and Boston, cities where you just don't have deals like this or don't have as many of them, because there's not as much need to fill those seats. You just have more people with more people in these cities, more people with money, and so you don't have that search for customers. I want to make sure that people in those cities knew that you had these opportunities in places like Baltimore or Pittsburgh or Cleveland or St. Louis, to make sure that people are aware of that and maybe consider moving to cities like that, because it's a pretty good life, actually.
We, of course, have a fairly high cost of living state here, but there's lots of bargains in Connecticut as well. If you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live, and always at WNPR.org. We'd like to hear from you. What are some great bargains in the arts, maybe in your small city or town, or maybe in one of the bigger cities here in Connecticut? Because there are a lot of these things available. Stand by for a moment, Alec, because I want to bring into the conversation Graham Beal, who's Director, President, and Chief Executive Officer at the Detroit Institute of Arts, one of the places that Alec profiles and one of the great art museums in America. Graham, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Tell us the story of Detroit and how you and the other arts institutions of that city have been able to stay afloat as we on the East Coast have heard so much about the troubles Detroit has been in. How have you been able to thrive and survive and move forward in this climate?
Well, basically because of consistent support from individuals and foundations. The business world has not been able to support us in the way that they used to. So we have astonishingly loyal supporters, and we remade the museum, reopening in 2007, completely rethinking how art is presented to the general public, and it was extremely successful. The museum became, in a sense, people felt that it was their museum. So when we went out to pass a regional property tax to restore our business model, which was based on serious public support, it passed to everyone's amazement. One of the quid pro quo of that was free admission for individuals in those counties. So the museum really has become the proverbial town square, and our annual attendance has gone from roughly 400 plus thousand to 600 plus thousand.
And that's quite a jump. So as you thought about rethinking the museum and making some of these changes, how was the museum regarded before? What did Detroiters or people in the greater Detroit region think of the museum before these changes, Graham?
A poll taken in 1999 indicated that it was viewed as the traditional country club, that it belonged to the elite, that it was essentially irrelevant to people's daily lives. And we set out to change that.
And Alec, it's one of the things that you address in your piece as well, that whether it's a symphony orchestra or it's a museum, institutions like this are trying all sorts of new things to draw people in, to break down these barriers, Alec, that the people have often had at the gates of a great arts institution that says it's for somebody else, it's not for you.
Right. One of the quite wonderful events I went to recently here in Baltimore was a concert last summer, in the middle of the summer, not part of the regular symphony season. It was called Beethoven and Bruges, and they had regular, very traditional Beethoven program, but then set up outside the symphony were all sorts of food carts and local microbrew vendors, and just drew this really large and very diverse crowd It cost all of $15 to get in for the for the actual concert. People were able to actually even bring in their cups of beer into the symphony if they wanted to, and it was just an incredibly sort of egalitarian kind of event, and the kind of thing that that these institutions are trying to do more of now. I should add that there's the Detroit angle brings up sort of one other element here, which is there's a definite kind of guilt that can come with this kind of, these kind of bargains if you're a consumer like myself, where you are aware of the fact that this culture, these offerings are coming to you at a bargain, and that there's a bit of a that it's not really paying the full price of what you're getting, and so you can't help but wonder, gosh, are these institutions are going to be able to make it on these rather sort of meager contributions that I'm making. That in Detroit just a few years ago, the symphony orchestra had to miss part of its season because their finances had gotten so dire, and so obviously there's a point at which these deals they can't go much lower, because otherwise these institutions just aren't going to be able to make it. And if you're a consumer, you just have to sort of accept the fact that they're offering you these prices and for a reason, because they want you to take them. And so you just have to kind of live with that. But there is that element as well.
I'm wondering, Graham, if you can address that balance that you have to strike, because obviously you want patrons to come in and enjoy the art, but you also want everyone to have the sense that art is worth something. It's not for free. How do you strike that balance with your patrons, with your donors, so that people understand that, you know, keeping a great museum in a great city is something that does cost some money?
Well, I don't want to oversimplify, but I think in our society, whether or not you really care about it, we are conditioned to regard art as something valuable. And taught to look at museums as special places. And I think a lot of the problems that museums have had in the past 40 years or so in trying to be as democratic as possible is that we were speaking a specialist language. People were coming into what they had been conditioned to think was going to be an uplifting, if not transformative, experience, and it didn't happen. And so that no real connections were made. There was nothing to demonstrate to individuals why these objects were so important to them. Or if it happened through the vehicle of art history, which is an intellectual activity and connoisseurship. So it's really a matter of finding ways to make those connections. And that is what all of our efforts were here to... We talk about the visitor-centered experience. All of our efforts have been made to have the general visitor feel that as soon as they walk in the building, they are in control and that they're looking at art on their own terms.
Graham, an awful lot of our listeners may remember the stories from a few years back on National Public Radio about your institution perhaps being forced to sell off some of its great works of art in order to help the city through its bankruptcy. Can you tell us the story of how you came through that and protected the amazing collection that you have?
Well, the collection was legally owned by the city, and we were looking at a serious legal fight establishing whether or not the collection was owned by the city as a public trust or whether it was an asset. And we were gearing up for that. I personally felt that we had a very, very good case. Literally, at the 11th hour, when we were getting ready to file to establish, I should say that the museum, though technically owned by the city, since 1998 has been run by a private non-profit organization. And so this organization that I work for was getting ready literally within hours of filing papers to establish our standing in court when we got word of this idea that became called the Grand Bargain, whereby foundations and the governor, businesses contributing to the DIA, put together a package of over $800 million to repair the pensions, the city pensions, that had been poorly managed for decades. because as the city manager in charge at the time said, not too many people cared about the creditors. They'd made a bet. They'd invested, and it was a poor investment. Mm-hmm. But we did care about thousands of people looking at impoverishment because their pensions were going to be drastically cut. And then in exchange for that $800+ million, the museum, the building, all of the assets, the collection, was handed over to the private nonprofit organization, actually making us more like most other U.S. museums. So it was a deal that brought the bankruptcy to a quick end and avoided what would have been years in the courts.
And now, of course, the Detroit Institute of Arts thriving and presenting works right now by Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo from the time that they spent in Detroit when Rivera was working on an amazing series of murals there. Graham Beal, congratulations on all the work that you've done at your institution. I appreciate you joining us and telling some of Detroit's story to our listeners here on Where We Live. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
And Alec McGillis, but before I let you go, I just have to ask another piece of this, which is, I think, so important about some of these Rust Belt cities. Yes, these big institutions, whether it's the Symphony Orchestra or the big art museums, they have to survive and thrive through adapting and finding new ways to attract artists. But the low cost of living in some of these places is also what draws young people who want to make a go of it in the arts or some other creative endeavor. And I think that that's a big piece of this, too, because, you know, the low cost of housing in some of these Rust Belt cities is going to draw people who want to support the arts long term.
Exactly. And that's what you're seeing here in Baltimore. You have, it's really kind of a two-part thing. You have these big, old, great high culture institutions that are that you still have there to take advantage of, but then you also have all this ferment down at the kind of at the other end of the spectrum, where you have lots of young artists coming to town to take advantage of this incredibly affordable space. You hear about that most famously, of course, in Detroit, where the space is as cheap as it can possibly get. But you also have it going on in other cities, including Baltimore. Just lots of activity of people starting to realize that, you know, you don't have to be in Brooklyn, you don't have to be in New York, that some of these other cities are simply getting too darn expensive. And I think it'd be great if you saw a little bit more sort of evening out of things with some of these cities that are just frankly just getting too crowded, and people moving from them into other places that just have lots of room to spare. And I just hope people sort of realize just how much of that is available out there, and do you see that trend continuing? Because it just seems like it's good for everyone involved.
But I also like this idea of a golden middle, of a place that is just big enough, and maybe Hartford, Connecticut, where I know you have some ties, fits into that mold as well, that they're big enough to be able to get together some critical mass, but not so big that you get lost in the mix of a New York or now a burgeoning Brooklyn.
Right, exactly.
Well, Alec McGillis, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for getting our conversation started. The Rust Belt Theory of Low-Cost High Culture, you wrote for Slate. Now Alec is going to go work as a political reporter for ProPublica, another one of our favorite publications online. Alec, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our program produced by Lydia Brown with Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Falarski. Thanks to our intern, Kelsey Bissell. You can continue our conversation on our website, wnpr.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.